Good afternoon. You're listening to The Colin McEnroe Show. I'm David Rose sitting in for Colin today. Lucky me, I'm excited about the show we have today. Hopefully you are too. We're going to be talking about pain, all different kinds of aspects about pain. We're going to talk about chronic pain, acute pain, people who feel pain constantly, all different kinds of things. First, we want to talk about what pain actually is. Now, we know that everybody sort of experiences pain a little bit differently. Some people have higher thresholds than pain. Some people have low thresholds for pain. Pain is just, it's a very subjective experience. So, you know, what really hurts somebody might not hurt somebody else, and for reasons that we don't fully understand. There are cultural factors such as emotion, there's genetics involved, there are environmental factors that impact how we experience pain. But what if scientists could actually use neuroimaging to show how our brain contributes to our perceptions of pain? And joining us from Oxford in the United Kingdom is somebody who can help us suss through all that. That is Irene Tracy. Irene heads the Nuffield Department of Clinical Neurosciences at the University of Oxford in the UK. She's also co-founder of the university's Oxford Center for Functional Magnetic Resonance Imaging of the Brain Center. Irene, welcome to the Colin McEnroe Show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation, David.
Absolutely. So let's get right into it. So you mentioned sort of how pain is subjective, and what you're trying to do is create a scientific map of the brain to sort of show, okay, maybe it is subjective, but also there are biological processes taking place here. So how is the work that you're doing, how is it going to help us understand pain and be able to really understand, you know, that maybe there is obviously the subjective element, but maybe there is some biological processes. So tell us what you do and how that helps us understand pain.
Sure.
From in the within the brain.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Yeah, so I'm sure all your listeners have experienced pain in their lives, and hopefully for most people it's just what we call good pain,
right.
Acute pain, you know, from a short injury, burning yourself in a candle, you know, a sports injury that sort of comes and goes. And it's good pain because it warns you that you've hurt yourself, so you look after the area that's damaged or you avoid the thing that caused the pain in the first place. So most people, if they just think about a pain experience they've had, even to something quite simple, you actually do quite a lot of things. You sort of locate it, you attend, you decide whether it's mechanical or thermal maybe, is it hot or is it cutting, or is it chemical like an acid burn, and you then often withdraw from it, you have an emotional reaction, and you do all that in an instant. And so that's the complex experience that we're trying to disentangle and understand. It's what we call a multifactorial or multidimensional experience because it has all these many elements to it. And what's been really challenging for us both at a scientific level but at a clinical level is because it's what we call a subjective experience, of course it always will be, it's what you feel as a private experience.
Right.
And we've got lots of different ways we can sort of gather how that might be for somebody by asking them and getting them to rate it and describe it or watching their behavior and how they might limp or you know, change the way that they're moving. Or look at sort of, you know, if they can't talk, if they're a baby or somebody anesthetized, you know, we've got other ways we could maybe see and infer what they might be doing. It's still problematic to sort of know on a, what we call a mechanistic level, what on earth is under the bonnet? What's behind that subjective experience that helps explain why they're having that pain in that particular way? And that's where some of these new techniques, particularly neuroimaging, are coming in to help us. I sort of call it looking under the bonnet at the sort of basic underpinning engine room of what generates that, what we call perception, that
right.
experience of pain. And so that's what a lot of groups like mine and many groups in the States have been spending the past couple of decades trying to take what is, you know, one of the oldest sensory and emotional experiences that we have and something that all animal species experience because of its importance, but really get a much better insight into the mechanisms that explain it. And importantly, what are the mechanisms that go wrong in, for unfortunately, 1 in 5 patients who end up in a chronic pain state where the pain's just there all the time and can be obviously extremely debilitating. So it's a huge medical health issue, this sort of more chronic pain, the bad pain, the dark side of pain, if you like. And again, what we hope is that the new science and what we're trying to do with, say, brain imaging will give us some insight into what's going wrong there.
Yeah, and you mentioned chronic pain, and what I didn't know until we started researching this show was that it's such a widespread issue among people now. I think it's there are more people experiencing chronic pain in the United States than are experiencing cancer, all different types of cancer, more
yeah.
people than heart disease. So it really is a public health issue that And to your point, because it's usually perceived as such a subjective thing, it's hard for people, a lot of people who don't see the pain. Like you say, when you talk about acute pain, you can see that somebody's cut. Okay, that hurts. But somebody who's experiencing chronic pain, you don't see where it comes from. People have a lot of trouble convincing people that they're feeling this pain.
Yeah.
So tell us
that's
a little
right.
bit about, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. You know, because it's this sort of hidden thing, there can be a lot of problems in, and also weird, interesting cultural biases and attitudes that we have as people sort of believing, you know, somebody really in that much pain, because it's very hard to know, you know, my pain's not the same as your pain and it never will be. And so when you can't sort of see it so obviously with the sort of, you know, tissue damage and blood and, you know, guts and gore, which is always the medical model we like. We like to see damage and then we can say, all right, fair enough, that probably hurts.
Right.
When it's sort of hidden and it's more complex, which often it is in these other diseases and disorders that cause problems inside the nerves that basically switch things on, it means when you're relying on just the person saying, I'm in absolute agony, you know, again, those biases come to play and that can be really problematic for the patients and obviously very challenging for clinicians to deal with it if we don't have tools to sort of see what's going on. So chronic pain, you know, people don't, as you say, appreciate just the enormity of the problem until latterly we've been doing audits both, you know, here in Europe, whilst Britain still is in Europe, and in the USA, that now we're sort of quantifying just the enormity of the problem, recognizing it dwarfs, you know, all these other major medical conditions. And it is now defined as one of the biggest major medical health problems that we have in the developed world, with not just a huge suffering for the patients, you know, one in five is a sort of minimum estimate, but a cost, you know, a huge cost to society, you know, $600 billion in the US alone per annum, you know, for the management and treatment. And of course, people not being able to get to work because of their chronic pain disorder, so not contributing to the economy. So this has got... this has got the sort of, you know, the politicians and it's got, you know, policymakers awake now to the problem. And of course, the opioid crisis is another issue that has highlighted, unfortunately, right. taken that to sort of highlight the problem. But it has. And so that's good because it means people now are aware of just this hidden burden that a lot of patients are suffering with.
And tell us about a little bit more about how clinicians deal with this. So if our doctors as aware, certainly we talk about the opioid crisis as a result of over-prescribing opioids to a lot of patients. Is a big contributing factor. But are clinicians aware of chronic pain or do patients still have trouble saying or convincing doctors that this is a real thing? Like, tell me, can you explain that?
I think it's getting better. I mean, I think it's definitely getting better, you know, and I say in the sort of pain field and people who are pain clinicians, you know, absolutely, you know, they're very engaged with, you know, obviously the new science and that conversation between what's been discovered and often the clinicians obviously themselves contributing to those discoveries. You know, that is improving for sure within clinical pain management, this awareness that chronic pain is something very different to what maybe triggered it in the first instance. So this idea that, you know, for a lot of chronic pain disorders, they are considered almost a disease in their own right. So in fact, the next classification, we have this sort of every few years, this new book that comes out that classifies different diseases. And in the next iteration of that, for the first time, chronic pain will have defined within it certain disorders that will be defined as a disease in their own right. So you've got chronic pain now is clearly a symptom of something else, and you need to fix something else, and hopefully the chronic pain will disappear. But in certain conditions, you know, this is now a life form in its own right, and understanding that new disease and that biology of that disease and what the mechanisms are that have gone wrong is the paradigm shift that the whole field has undergone. That's very well understood, I would say, in the sort of scientific world, in the pain world, in the pain clinical world. It is not prevalent yet, I would say, more broadly in the medical profession and then broadly out in society. So this really important, but it's subtle, but it's an important distinction between acute and chronic pain being two very different things, obviously, but chronic pain also not being just a reflection of, you know, a symptom of what caused it, but potentially having a lot of mechanisms that are there sustaining it, exacerbating it, converting people into it in their own right. And that's important because it's those mechanisms that we need to target. And although it's been a fairly bleak picture for patients in terms of not very effective therapies over the past few decades, that new shift in the way we think about things has afforded us the opportunity to discover that new biology and come up with new targets. And I would be very optimistic going forward about where we're going in this next decade in terms of being able to target now that new discovery science and hopefully have some very exciting, you know, potentially very effective therapies for patients.
I mean, you sound pretty optimistic, which is making me feel pretty good about where we're headed. But I guess when I stop and think about clinicians, or those are the sort of people who are dealing around the front lines of people with pain. So,
yeah.
You know, certainly your people in your field who are studying this know what's happening. And you pointed to, you know, you think it's getting better, but it still seems like there still are some things that that clinicians need to know. And what sort of, and the fact that they don't know this, what sort of impact is that having on people? I mean, it's got to be having some sort of psychological impact on people who suffer and they're not getting the right answers when they go to the doctor.
Yeah, sure. But, you know, this is something that, you know, is problematic, not just, I would say, for pain science. This is true for all, you know, what we call discovery science being translated quickly enough, efficiently enough out there, you know, and this is true for many of the different disorders, particularly the central nervous system, so things that go wrong. You know, we would all love to see a faster translation of that knowledge and that information and implementation of it. And you're quite right, you know, to point that, you know, this isn't happening quick enough, and therefore there's a cost, you know, for patient, you know, care in the context of that. But that isn't a unique problem, I'd say, to pain. That would be true for a lot of different clinical conditions. I think in the pain space, maybe we've been, you know, a bit slow in sort of recognizing these distinctions and having the investment and the funding to sort of drill down what some of these unique specific mechanisms are that underpin chronic pain and its maintenance. But, you know, as I say, I'm an optimist anyway, but I have seen, you know, having been in this field for best part of, 20 odd years, there's an acceleration in these past, particularly in the past 5 years, and a shift. So, and that's speeding up. And I think, you know, things that are going on at the moment in terms of large funding packages, you know, driven by NIH and, you know, global consortia to address very specific problems, is getting the message out there to that broader medical community who are maybe not pain specialists, and recognizing we've got to do something different. We've got to change the way we address this. And again, you know, the sort of tools that we use, although they're not at this stage, you know, for prime time use in a physician's, you know, patient waiting room and clinic, you know, they're at least informing changes of attitudes and understanding. So right. Understanding that, you know, for instance, some of the work, you know, that we and others have done have really proven that factors like people's anxiety and their, you know, maybe their depression, their, you know, their expectations, you know, these don't just influence the way they describe their pain. This actually changes through brain mechanisms the processing of those signals that the area of damage is sending in. So it changes in a very powerful way the physiology of that experience, and it changes therefore the experience. And that was not understood until we had tools that could see it and prove it with experiments.
Right.
So that changes again, you know, that information that's getting out there by, you know, people publishing and giving talks and doing shows like this and just getting the message out is really empowering, because it means that people then take as seriously those factors as the more comfortable model of where's the damage and let's just fix the thing that's sort of obviously gone wrong. It's recognizing that these slightly more, you know, ethereal, difficult to pin down factors that are very brain-based, like your emotions, like your cognitive state, your attentional state, the context in which you're experiencing your pain or your relief, will powerfully influence the actual physiology of the processing. Mm. And because pain is this experience that the brain produces, and these are where they occur, this is going to have this combined effect, and therefore we've got to treat them as seriously as the sort of traditional, you know, let's go and fix the thing that's been damaged.
Right. I wonder, and you alluded to this, if sort of the reason why pain studies have lagged behind other areas in the scientific realm is part of this idea, what you just described, is sort of this subjective nature of it, the fact that there are these other factors that are involved. And one of the things that was fascinating to me as we were sort of looking into this is some of the studies you've done looking at placebo and anticipation and how those things actually influence pain. Could you talk a little bit about, let's start with the placebo effect and how that sort of plays out?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, placebo, I think, has been a really, really interesting area that several groups have used a different, you know, lots of different techniques to understand it. You know, it's something that we've known right back from Hippocrates' time and Galen, you know, this powerful influence that expectation can have on your outcome. And so this has been a very well-observed phenomenon for several thousand years. It's been very well applied in medicine. We seem to have sort of forgotten actually just how good it is in recent years and sort of treat it as a dirty word and as something that, again, you know, has a sense of deception and fakery, because that in effect is how you elicit the effect, is you sort of trick people into expecting something and then you give them the sugar pill or the saline. And part of it is this trickery, but really what you're doing in that trickery is you're changing their expectations. So this is a very important aspect of it. And that is something that is a very powerful phenomenon, which of course is happening in every patient-physician interaction. In that therapeutic alliance, there is a managing of expectations, there is a handling of them, there is a setting up of them, and there is a dispelling of others. You know, patients will come in with all sorts of expectations and experiences about what drugs have done to them, or side effects, or what they think other physicians have told them, or what they've read on Google or Wikipedia. Mm. And these are all playing out through mechanisms in the brain, and a physician will work through those and they'll walk out the room and remember not very much of that conversation, about 30% generally, and that will be a set of expectations that, to a certain extent, you know, I think physicians obviously, you know, would need to recognize how much power they have over those expectations. Yeah. But those expectations will really play out, again, physiologically, on how well that particular, whether it's a drug or a surgical intervention, is going to work. And so what the science has been doing is around sort of placebo-type experiments, but also just experiments, even giving a real drug like we did, but changing people's expectations, has shown, again, with the sort of objective imaging data, that this powerfully changes the way signals are processed. So I might burn you, you know, to exactly the same level, you know, and I keep burning you at 50 degrees, and I can give you a drug, but I might not tell you when I start the drug, or I might pretend I stop the drug when I don't. Mm. And in this experiment, which is sort of describing one of the experiments we did, you know, you've been given the same pain stimulus, you've been given the same amount of drug. All I've done is sneakily manipulate your expectation. When you didn't know it was on, I told you then the drug was on, and then I pretended it stopped. But actually, the drug was on all the time. And I can make your behavioral ratings go all anywhere I want. I can make you completely obliterate and feel no analgesia to that drug because you think the drug has stopped when it has. And what the imaging tells us is, how is that happening? How is it that that sort of negative expectation where you think, oh my God, the drug has stopped now, it's going to be really painful, but it hasn't, but is enough to make you think it has, and then we can go behind the scenes and see, you know, the drug is still working, it's still doing its job, but this other bit of the brain is now driving what we call nocebo effects, and that negative expectation is enough to make you really think that you're still in as much pain as you were at the start, when actually certain other bits of the brain have been switched off because the drug is in there.
Wow.
And so these are the sort of fun experiments we can do that, again, they're fun to do scientifically because you discover lots about what the brain does, but they're important therapeutically because it proves that expectation is really powerful in the therapeutic outcome. And this, you know, we've been able to translate, you know, very rapidly into very interesting areas, which, again, the listeners would be probably surprised to hear, but in surgical experiments surgical operations where people are doing surgeries, and for a lot of surgeries where the point of the surgery is to maybe alleviate pain, unlike drug discovery where there's always a control arm or a placebo-controlled arm, in surgery there isn't one. There's no sham surgery because of the risks of supposedly giving somebody an anesthetic and doing an operation, but not actually doing the operation.
Right, right.
But latterly, there's been several experiments being done, and I've been involved with one with my colleagues here in Oxford, a very common shoulder surgery, and my surgical colleagues were very brave and said, you know what, I'm not sure that actually what we're doing mechanistically has any effect. It's probably placebo. This has taken 10 years to do the study, a large clinical trial, and basically the outcome was the surgery is actually doing nothing. When you actually do the placebo surgery, there's no difference.
So that's
this is
so fascinating.
Important because, again, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's absolutely amazing. So, of course, you know, this is not a popular result to publish. There's a lot of heated discussion, as you could imagine.
Yeah.
But it's important because it, again, illustrates, I think, to the patients and to the community and to the clinical community that these factors like expectation, which is built on what placebos are doing, work and they're powerful. Of course, now we have to decide ethically, well, if that's how you elicit pain relief, maybe we should do placebo surgeries. You know, and that's a bigger discussion. But, you know, that's where we're sort of the conversation sort of at this point left, and we have to continue.
So that seems such a powerful thing, you know, tying this sort of expectation into whether or not you're going to experience pain, having that actual impact on what you feel. I mean, what do you think that means in terms of us being able to self-regulate? I mean, could we just start telling ourselves we're not going to feel pain? Or then you think about that sort of makes me think about, you know, monks who sort of meditate and immediately think of the monk from who was protesting the occupation in Vietnam, who lit himself on fire and just sat there and burned and died and didn't flinch. I mean, are there ways that we can? I mean, this is a little bit outside of your expertise, but, you know, what are your thoughts about that? Just this self-regulating by using your own expectations?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You know, sort of, you know, the capacity of the brain to change the experience is huge. And it can do it, you know, one of the most common routes by which, say, the placebo effect or expectation mediates what I call free analgesia is the same as when people are distracted. People are probably, listeners, you know, done sports, they've hurt themselves in the high arousal excitement of maybe winning the point. They didn't notice, you know, they'd hurt themselves, and then afterwards it hurts. So these sort of experiences of where you realize, wow, how come I didn't feel it at the time, is because we've got this very, very powerful system in our brains, in old brain, it's called the brainstem, where we've got this, I call it good cop, bad cop. And this good cop basically inhibits the signals. It just stops them coming in to the brain, so you don't feel it. And this is, in fact, the system that the placebo effect and expectation hijacks. So it's this beautiful old system, and it's this wonderful set of machinery that we've all got that we can tap into, and we tap into it to block pain so that you're not having to deal with the pain because there's something more threatening or more important to be dealing with. So the brain's very efficient. It's got that system, which is powerfully the system that is what expectation, placebo, distraction, fight or flight taps into. But then it's got this sort of additional system, which is what I'd call sort of reappraisal. So the analogy would be if people are runners and maybe, you know, I've done a couple of marathons, and after I've done, say, a long training run, next day my muscles are aching, really sore. But that's nice pain. I like that pain because I'm appraising that pain as something that's positive. It means I've done a good training run, I'm reaching my target, my goal is there. It's positive for me because I've reinterpreted what that pain means and not being something negative, which of course naturally it is for the patients. But what we can show experimentally is we can hedonically flip it and reappraise it into something positive. And then we can work out with brain imaging how that happens. Wow. So going back to your monks and the meditation, hypnosis, sort of these alternative ways that one can, that we know historically people have used to help with their suffering, now we know why they do it and why it is not fake. It is true. It's physiological. It plays out through networks that now we can do imaging experiments to find out how did that work. And it turns out all these have, you know, very interesting avenues by which they activate specific networks that can produce and drive, you know, benefits. It can either drive absolute analgesia, or it can change the subjective value of what the experience is and sort of hedonically flip it. And so I think that's what's been, again, very interesting, because it just, again, well, not only just proves that these things do work and they're not just made up, but of course it gives us insight as to, well, how can we now unlock that? What would be the keys that we could use to unlock those networks in the brain for patients so that they can get that free analgesia or that free way of reinterpreting things? And that's where working with clinical psychologists who are trying to, again, use what's coming out from the science in this context to help their patients access some of this and help them cope and deal with their pain better is where there's a sort of win-win combination. So, so what you're saying is absolutely spot on. You know, we're on our journey to understand how some of these long historic, you know, things that have been done in history have been used, like the monks meditating, and we're now starting to understand a little bit how it is that that has come about, and then of course we can exploit that hopefully going forward for better therapies.
Wow, so many interesting things to talk about. We do have to take a break though. I just want to say quickly before we go to break, the work that you're doing is or could be used eventually, possibly, in court cases where they're talking about, you know, how do you quantify someone's pain. So if somebody is trying to prove pain and suffering, there might be a way to do that through some of your research. So I want to say a quick thank you to you, Irene Tracy. You're the head of the Nuffield Department of Clinical Neurosciences at the University of Oxford. Thank you so much for joining us, Irene.
You're very welcome. All the best to you.
Coming up, we'll have two guests to talk about a rare condition called man-on-fire syndrome, which causes a person to feel intense pain almost all the time. Please stick around. And we're back. Thanks so much for joining this afternoon. We're talking about pain this hour. Our next guest has spent decades seeking a treatment for people suffering from chronic neuropathic pain by studying people with a rare disease called inherited erythromelalgia. Well, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Also known as man on fire syndrome. Joining him is a woman who's lived with this rare and challenging syndrome her entire life. So with us, we have Stephen Waxman. He's a professor of neurology at the Yale Medical School and Veterans Affairs Connecticut Medical Center. He's also author of Chasing Men on Fire, the story of the search for a pain gene. So thanks so much for joining us, Stephen.
Glad to be here.
And also is Pamela Costa. She's a psychology professor at Tacoma Community College in Washington. She's a licensed clinical psychologist, and she's lived with this inherited erythromelalgia for her entire life. Pamela, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
So, Stephen, let's start with you. Just can you just describe what this condition is, otherwise known as man on fire syndrome? What kind of people are affected? Is it genetic? What are some of the symptoms?
Sure. Erythromelalgia is a very rare disorder, and about 5 or 10% of people with erythromelalgia have the inherited form. Mm. Inherited erythromelalgia, IEM, it's very rare but a very important disease, and as you noted, it's also called the man on fire syndrome. People with inherited erythromelalgia feel searing, burning pain in response to mild warmth, warmth that most of us feel is pleasant or that we don't feel at all. And so wearing shoes, putting on a sweater, sitting in a room at 70 degrees Fahrenheit can trigger severe excruciating pain. And it's described by people with this disorder as feeling as if hot lava had been poured into their bodies.
Oof, ouch. Pamela, you're talking on the phone with us. How is talking on the phone? Is that something that is a painful experience? Do you have to have us on speakerphone, or what's that like?
I automatically put people on speakerphone because the phone can become warm after a few minutes. Mm. So that's pretty automatic. I didn't even realize that I had done it. But yes.
That's what you do, yeah.
Have you on speaker.
Well, so that's, I guess there are certain things you probably have to do to accommodate your life. So, I mean, can you just walk us through what sort of things do you have to do like that to sort of accommodate your condition?
Well, having the rare or inherited form of erythromelalgia has afforded me with the natural or more unconscious kind of daily adaptation. I've always had to make these constant adjustments without any kind of awareness that I was doing it over the years. So I didn't recognize that, for example, I would plan out my days as a young child, walking to school, where were the puddles that I could put my feet in en route to the 10 blocks to school in Southern California. Wow. I didn't realize that other people failed to do the same thing because I didn't have a diagnosis at the time. Right. It wasn't until I was a preteen that we received the diagnosis from the Mayo Clinic. So kind of being unaware of having this disease and assuming everybody else was on fire, if you will, like me, I just kind of adapted. And so I wasn't real cognizant of the little kind of minor, little micro adjustments that I would make throughout my day until I finally just asked my family, you know, what do I do differently than you? And I know I have to plan from the moment I wake up how long it takes to, say, recover from my shower. So I have to take a cold shower, which I still feel cold, so it's uncomfortable but not painful. So I choose the cold shower on a cold day even over a warm shower. So then the shower stimulates my pain, so I have to adjust for 20 minutes to up to about 3 hours of hurting after that. Mm. And then I have to plan for how far I'm going to have to walk because movement and mobility triggers where I have to go. So if I have to go outside, that means wearing clothes and wearing, you know, more than just a t-shirt and shorts.
Yeah.
It also requires wearing shoes, which I don't own any socks or enclosed shoes. I only wear very light sandals, and that's difficult to navigate through the snow.
And yeah,
so that kind of presents a different problem than summertime, which for most erythromelalgia patients is very challenging because of the heat. Mm-hmm. And as Dr. Waxman said, it does. It feels like we're on fire. I'm burning constantly from the inside out. And while that constant hum or burn is there, there are certain events that if I don't control them, and some are totally uncontrollable, like a warm building, throughout my day, it's exacerbated even further and compounded and makes recovery even more difficult.
So what was it like growing up not having a diagnosis? You know, for people who go to the doctor with chronic pain, not your condition, but have chronic pain, often have a hard time convincing the doctor they have chronic pain. I mean, I can only imagine what that was like for you.
Oh, it numerous doctors over decades, in fact. Despite the fact that I had the Mayo Clinic diagnosis when I was 12, and I carried that letter around with me wherever I went, because of the rare, you know, because it was so rare, and at the time when I was younger, I didn't have the physical, the outward signs, so it was just what I could subjectively explain. I'm burning from the inside out, my hands, my feet, my face, my legs burn. I didn't have the redness at the time. So the erythema, or the redness, didn't start to really show until I was in my 20s. So not having any outward sign of pathology and then having this, this report of this rare kind of strange syndrome, I've had numerous, probably countless, over 30 or 40 physicians, including world-renowned healthcare providers that I was fortunate enough to have access to. So head of rheumatology at UCLA, Stanford, and so on. It really just would be kind of just this roadblock every time I went. I get my hopes up for this new specialist is going to know what this is. Mm-hmm. And even if they knew what it was by, say, looking it up and reading about it, they still would deny that I had it. So up until I was in my mid-20s, it was a psychosomatic disorder. But I should thank that for, you know, allowing me to pursue psychology, because that's how, that was my own way of trying to figure out, well, if it's psychosomatic, that's the direction I'd better go academically and professionally to find my own cure, if you will.
You definitely made some lemonade out of that lemon. I want to turn to Stephen Waxman. Can you just explain what's happening with Pamela's body and her brain that's leading to this condition?
Sure. Inherited erythromelalgia, in many ways, serves as a model disease. And for scientists like me who are trying to develop new treatments for chronic neuropathic pain, it's been a model disease that has taught us some very important lessons. And that's important because in developing a new medicine, you have to target the right molecule in the body. Here, the man on fire syndrome, inherited erythromelalgia, has pointed us to a master molecule that controls pain. So it points to a new target that hopefully will enable the development of a new class of pain medications. And the story is that having done a lot of work at the laboratory bench on pain and pain signaling neurons, in 2003, my team and I here at Yale launched a worldwide search for families with inherited neuropathic pain.
Okay.
As a neurologist, I can tell you we see neuropathic pain all the time, but we never see families. So we knew that if families existed, they'd be very rare. Why search the globe for rare families? And the reason is that rare familial diseases can teach us lessons about common disorders. An example is the development of the statin drugs, which have been a major advance in public health. These drugs were developed on the basis of studies on very rare families with inherited hypercholesterolemia. The genes in those families pointed the way to the cholesterol story and enabled the development of the statin drugs.
Okay.
So we were looking for a pain gene, a master gene for pain. And in 2005, we identified that gene, largely from studies in Pam's family.
Wow.
And we learned from studies of that sort that a molecule called NaV1.7 is a master regulator for pain. It's also called SCN9A. Now, NaV1.7 is a molecular battery. It enables pain signaling nerve cells in our peripheral nerves to generate impulses. And so it controls pain signaling. And families like Pam's carry mutations that make NaV1.7 overactive. It's sort of like turning up the volume knob on a radio. But in this case, NaV1.7 is a volume knob on our pain-signaling nerve cells. So in a family like Pam's, it's as if the volume knob has been turned all the way up in pain-signaling nerves, and that makes these pain-signaling nerve cells shriek when they should be whispering, and that causes extreme pain.
Ouch. Oh, it's going to be hurt thinking about it. Well, maybe the gene, instead of having this numerical letter name, could be called the Costa gene, the Costa family gene. Yeah, give them some credit.
It could be called the Waxman gene.
The Waxman gene, the Waxman Costa gene. Well, can we talk a little bit more about your family, Pam? So if it is genetic, is this something that your family members have? Did your parents have it? You have cousins? Like,
yes.
Tell us about that.
My mother, my grandfather, and 14 or more cousins on my maternal side, yes.
Wow. And so is it as extreme as your case, or they experience the same types of pain, or is it different for them?
They experience the same sensation of burning, yes. And in fact, some of the studies going back, in terms of the pedigree studies going back, I think up to about five generations, in fact, demonstrate in terms of, you know, patient description, the same intensity and description and what it feels like and the avoidance of heat and movement and so on. However, within just my kind of small family cohort, if you will, there's a lot of variation in terms of intensity and frequency, which probably makes it even more difficult for physicians to understand, outside of Dr. Waxman and his team, of course. So my mother, for example, doesn't have it nearly as badly as I do. So that is why she failed to really recognize it until much later on, when she noticed that I was aversive to shoes and socks, for example, and that PE at school or recess at school in Southern California was very, very challenging for me. And my teachers were concerned about me not wanting to participate, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an understatement.
Wow.
When the Mayo Clinic first identified my family in Alabama, they reached out to my mother and I because they assumed that from recollection of my family, my mother's family, of her experience as a child, they had an assumption that perhaps she and I probably had some experience with it. Little did they know that we were suffering on the West Coast while they were in Alabama, suffering just as much, but being investigated already by the Mayo Clinic researchers back in the 70s.
Stephen, real quick, we have to go to break, but I want to get your thoughts on where you are with your work now. Where are you with clinical trials, and what's on the horizon for you and your work?
Well, it's an incredibly exciting time. The mutation in Pam's family is what we call a gain-of-function mutation, an overactive NaV1.7 channel causing severe pain. We now also know there are other families with loss of function of NaV1.7. They don't make the NaV1.7 channel, and these remarkable and very rare families feel no pain. So painless fractures, painless burns, painless tooth extractions, painless childbirth. So we're in the unusual situation of having both sides of the coin, gain of function and loss of function mutations, and that has propelled a lot of interest in the biopharmaceutical industry. And so our goal is the development of new medications that can block NaV1.7, hopefully as a treatment for many forms of neuropathic pain, painful diabetic neuropathy, shingles neuropathy, the neuropathy that can occur with cancer chemotherapy, and some patients opt to stop their chemotherapy because the neuropathy is so painful. Pain after nerve injury and pain after traumatic limb amputation. And importantly, the NaV1.7 molecule does not do anything important in the brain, and so medications that block it will not have brain-related side effects such as double vision, loss of balance, confusion, or sleepiness. And so our team at Yale is working with the biopharmaceutical industry, and the first early clinical trials have provided very encouraging results. These have involved tiny, small numbers of patients, but we have hints. We have hints that blocking of NaV1.7 may reduce or totally ameliorate pain. So it's going to take time, and by time I mean years, not months, and I can't say how many years because this work goes slowly. And, of course, there are no guarantees, but I am very optimistic.
Wow. Wow, makes me feel good again. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Stephen Waxman, your neurology professor at Yale Medical School and the Veterans Affairs Connecticut Medical Center. Thank you for joining us. And Pamela Costa, psychology professor at Tacoma Community College. Thank you so much, Pam and Stephen, for joining us.
Sure. My pleasure.
When we come back from the break, we're going to switch species, and we're going to talk about whether fish feel pain. Stay with us. Good afternoon. I'm David Roche, sitting in for Colin McEnroe Show today. We're talking about pain. We are switching species. We've been talking about pain in human beings, but obviously we're not the only species that feel pain. It might come to a surprise to some listeners that fish actually experience pain. I know I grew up not thinking that, but some reading about it has changed my mind. Now there's little doubt among researchers that fish feel pain. And they also, there's evidence that they feel fear and many of the emotions that we tend to only associate with people. Yet, at the same time, millions of fish are killed every single year by suffocation in nets or barbed hooks. Commercial fishing is a big part of this why that is happening. And with almost 3 billion people globally relying on fish as their primary source of protein, maybe it's time to eat less fish or kill them in a more humane way. So joining us to kind of suss through all that is Carl Safina. He is a professor for nature and humanity at Stony Brook University, and he also runs the Safina Center. He's also author of several books, including Song for the Blue Ocean and most recently Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Carl Safina, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great pleasure to be here.
So can you just maybe explain for listeners who might have been surprised by that opening statement about fish feeling pain, why have we traditionally felt that fish have not felt pain, and what sort of research has led us to believe, they actually do?
Well, I think that why, if you're asking for a logical answer about why we have believed fish don't feel pain, it's that it's very convenient to believe fish don't feel pain. If you look at how they act, it's very logical to assume that they do feel pain and fear because they act fearful in dangerous situations, and they seem to be in pain when you would be in pain. So we've just told ourselves a story that they can't feel pain or don't feel anything. But if you actually look at their nervous systems or you look at the research, you realize that they do feel, and they feel pain, and they feel some basic emotions like stress and fear and things like that.
So is it more than just reacting? Do we know that they're actually having, like, I guess, what is it, some of the evidence that they're feeling pain is that they will develop behaviors that will make them pain averse, or they'll do things that they'll avoid the pain. So do we know that it's not just, they're not just reacting to stimuli, that they're actually experiencing pain as we know it, as we understand it?
Well, first of all, I mean, pain is a reaction to stimuli. It's a sensation that is formed in the brain, and then based on that sensation, it's a sensation to dangerous or harmful stimuli, and then you react in an appropriate way, which is you move away from the harmful or dangerous stimuli. Fish not only do the same thing, but when you do experiments to try to dial that down a little bit, you see behavior that is essentially impossible to explain any other way. For instance, you take a trout, you inject into its lip basically a saline salt water substance that shouldn't make them feel anything, and they don't do anything. You inject into their lip another substance that is known to cause a stinging sensation in humans, and they start rubbing their lip on rocks and on the sides of their tank as if it is irritating them or stinging them. So trying to explain that in a different way is impossible as far as I know, because nobody's been able to explain it in a different way, and I can't think of another way to explain it.
Now, so if we can agree that fish experience pain, it would be virtually impossible to say that they experience it as we do because our brains are so differently. But how is there a way that you could characterize their experience of it? Is that possible, or how do we know? Like, how different is it, or how similar is it to the pain that we experience? Is there a way that we can even know that?
Well, I think the best answer is it's somewhere in the same envelope that we experience pain. In other words, different people experience a different range of pain, or experience pain more acutely or less acutely to the same stimuli. Some people just are more sensitive, and some people are less sensitive to certain stimuli as far as how much pain they experience or how much they are willing to tolerate or what they report as extreme pain. But their brains are not that similar, not that dissimilar, not that different from ours. Our brain is basically an elaborated fish brain. So the most fundamental things like danger and getting away from danger and damage and pain are likely to be rather similar. I think that fish probably experience a pain in a way that we would recognize as a pain. And as I mentioned about those experiments, they act like we would act. Mm-hmm. So while I don't, you can't say exactly how they experience pain, for that matter, I don't know exactly how you experience pain, but I know that we all have a sensation of pain. So
sure.
My feeling is it's pretty similar. They act as though it's pretty similar, and that's where I think the information puts us at this point.
So we only got about a minute left, but I wanted you to touch on...
Yeah,
I know. It goes by quick. I know. Sorry about that. But I wanted you to touch on the global fishing industry. I mean, if fishing generally is causing pain to fish, I mean, are there more humane ways that we could be going about this?
Well, at the scale that we kill trillions of fish in gigantic nets, there is really... It's not a humane enterprise. The way that we kill fish that are raised in fish farms, yes, we have much more control over how they are killed because they're generally killed individually. And in a couple of countries in Europe, they actually do now have both some regulations about how fish need to be slaughtered. They have to be anesthetized or stunned first, similar to the way hoofed air breathing farm animals in this country have to be stunned first.
Hmm. So, but then if you're talking about eating farm fish, that raises a whole other set of ethical questions, because now these fish are, you know, not living a free life. I know you've written about your experience mm-hmm. in a fish farm.
Everything raises a lot of ethical questions, and it's, living is sort of an ethical obstacle course, and you have to try to pick a way through that. I think that involves an amount of ethical compromise that you can live with, because there's no free lunch.
I was reading about the Japanese fish kill method, the ikijimi. Is that something for personal fishermen? Is that something you recommend personal fishermen do when they catch fish, to kill the fish in a humane way? I don't know if you've heard of that.
I actually still go fishing. And the way that I've approached it has changed a bit based on what I know. I try to make it very quick, and I try to kill the fish fast or painlessly. I think you can kill a fish painlessly by slipping it into ice water, and since they're not warm-blooded animals, so their temperature cools down, and then that's the end for them. So I try to do that rather than just let them expire out in the air gasping to death.
Mm. Well, Carl Safina, we have run out of time, but thank you so much for talking to us about fish and how they experience pain. Thank you, your professor of nature and humanity at Stony Brook University. Thank you, Carl.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure, a very quick pleasure.
Maybe next time we'll have some more time. Also want to thank those who made today's show very, very special. Our guests, Irene Tracy, Stephen Waxman, Pamela Costa, and you just heard from Carl Safina. But a very special thanks to producer Betsy Kaplan, who without her help, none of this would have been possible. Or technical producer Kylan Wolf, who also nailed it at the boards. And our intern, Kayla Thomas. I'm David DeRoche, in for Colin McEnroe on tomorrow's show. Are we hardwired to dance? We'll rebroadcast an old favorite.